This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so we take some time to dive beneath the headlines on one of the biggest stories of the week. And this week, it's education. A busy week for Boston Public Schools, starting with an 11th-hour agreement with state officials to stave off direct state intervention.
It's the mayor we need to thank. She took personal responsibility for the functioning of the school system.
That was Massachusetts Education Commissioner Jeff Riley there. Now, that agreement prevented a state takeover, as well as some other levels of state control in the district for now. For Boston Teachers Union President Jessica Tang, it's something that should never have even been considered.
I'm disappointed because these threats should never have been on the table in the first place.
On top of all of that, school committee members chose a new leader for BPS on Wednesday. Mary Skipper says she's ready to get to work on some of the fundamental services that BPS provides, like transportation, safe buildings, proper learning materials, and teacher training.
Those are all of the things that help our staff and our community feel ready and trustworthy in the work that we do. So that's going to be the priority. It won't be shiny and it won't be sexy, but it will be foundational and it will make a difference to students.
There's a lot to unpack, so let's get to it. And here to help us with that is Paul Revel. He has served as the Massachusetts Secretary of Education under Governor Deval Patrick, and he's now a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Paul, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you.
So like I said, there is a lot to unpack this morning in the district. So I want you to weigh in first. What are the biggest, or what is the biggest of these two headlines?
Well, I think the biggest of the headlines is we have a new leader. We have a very distinguished education leader with a very solid track record, particularly on equity issues and on issues of teaching and learning. You know, she's a compassionate, experienced, seasoned, committed veteran who knows how to get things done. She has spent a great deal of time in the Boston Public Schools, so she's got a deep network of relationships. And she's going to lead us into the next chapter, which will include dealing with this new agreement with the state and, most importantly, attending to the whole series of problems that have been beleaguering the Boston Public Schools for some while and beginning to make progress in solving those problems and doing better by our children.
I want to talk about that agreement, too, that the avoidance of the state takeover, receivership, all of that. So can you talk to me first a little bit about the relationship between BPS and the State Board of Education, especially? What are the dynamics at play there?
Well, the State Board of Education has a responsibility to oversee schools and districts and to deal with chronic underperformance. And I think the state justifiably had ongoing concerns about Boston. The threat of a takeover, I think, was somewhat exaggerated in the hope of pressuring Boston into signing an agreement. I'm not sure that there was really the votes were really there on the state board to take over the Boston Public Schools, but there was certainly an expression of urgency and concern. The state had issued a report pre-COVID, and not much progress has been made relative to that report. Some progress. They issued a second report just recently. I think the state saw the opportunity to put some pressure on Boston at the time a new leader was in place, both in the mayor's office and in the superintendent's office, to try and get a very clear agenda. So I think the new agreement, while I'm disappointed with it as a whole because it's less of a partnership between the state and the local school district than I had hoped to see, it is a set of targets. It's, in my view, kind of a compliance agreement that sets some targets. They're legitimate targets. They're things that need to be done, and sets a period of time in which those targets need to be met, and creates at least the foundation for what I hope, under the leadership of Mary Skipper and Jeff Riley, who know one another and have worked together actually in the Boston Public Schools, as they develop that relationship around those targets, they can in fact build a genuine partnership, because it's going to take all hands on deck to solve the problems. The problems that have been described in the Boston Public Schools are not simple. They're deep, they're longstanding, and they're complex. And we're going to need really the whole community to come to the table. So a vast array of partnerships, but it starts with the state and the local district working together.
Well, given the complexity of some of these issues and also having targets and goals they have to meet, there is a timeline around that. Do you think it is doable? Is the timeline too short? What's your thoughts there?
Well, I think you have to take it item by item. Some of them, I think, are probably reaching and maybe not so realistic. I mean, a 99% on-time rate for the buses when the school district has struggled mightily with transportation for years now, even pre-COVID, now post-COVID, we have staff shortages. And so getting that in place on time relative to this, I think, is a bit of a stretch. I think there's some other things like that in there. But I also think that top leaders will find a way to negotiate. The district and the state are going to be meeting on a regular basis. You know, the mayor has taken substantial responsibility for what's going to happen here, so she's going to bring city resources to bear. There's a good deal of talk about creating a children's cabinet to bring all those agencies, organizations, and individuals who care about children's well-being to the table. So I think it's good to have the pressure of timelines, and at the same time, an agreement like this is going to require some flexibility and adaptability in terms of its implementation.
Right. It sounds like Riley does have a good amount of faith in Mayor Wu. It sounds like you would agree with that. Am I right?
Well, I think they're in the early stages of forming a relationship, and I think they haven't had that much time together. The negotiations around this agreement, I think, have been strained at times. And so now that an agreement has been formalized, I think both parties want the best for kids in the Boston Public Schools. So I think they've both committed to building a better, stronger partnership kind of relationship going forward. Getting a new superintendent in place was the first step. That's a big first step. I mean, I think we're on the threshold of what could be a bright new chapter for the Boston Public Schools. And gosh knows, we desperately need that. But it's going to take strong working relationships between the key partners here, starting with the mayor, the state commissioner, and the superintendent of schools.
So we also spoke with a teacher earlier this morning, Nima Avashia. She is a middle school teacher at BPS. Mm-hmm. And she told us that she is feeling cautiously optimistic this week after a tumultuous couple of years for the district.
I think actually for the first time in a long time, instead of feeling like there are all these like axes hanging over our heads, it actually feels like things maybe can settle a little bit and we can actually focus on doing the work.
So based on what you just said, Paul, it does sound like you're optimistic about what's to come too.
I think I'm in the same camp. I think there's, you know, in every crisis, there's an opportunity. Here, there's a big opportunity. And taking advantage of the opportunity is really the charge for leadership. I think we've got three terrific leaders in place in the key seats that I was just talking about. We've got a new visionary mayor with a big popular mandate behind her. We've got a superintendent of schools who's got deep experience as a superintendent and knows at the same time the Boston Public Schools intimately and has had great success in her career as an educator. And we've got Jeff Riley, who's a first-rate commissioner. He has got a reputation, worked deeply in Lawrence as the receiver up and superintendent up there. He knows the Boston Public Schools well, and they all care deeply about children. I mean, the commissioner and the mayor both have children in the public schools. The superintendent has had in the past and has spent her career there. So I think we're off to a very good start. So there's every reason to be optimistic. There are lots of pitfalls because these are complicated, difficult problems, and they require lots of cooperation from all kinds of formal government bodies and then groups and organizations in town who have to agree to kind of check our swords and shields at the door, whatever feelings we have about what's happened in the recent past. We've got to set them aside and figure out what do we want to achieve for children. And I think that's fairly obvious. We want to educate them so that they can, they can be good citizens and leaders, so that they can be employees and work and support themselves in a high knowledge, high skill economy. They can be fulfilled individuals and lifelong learners. And then figure out how do we do that? And where have we gone wrong? What's getting in the way of our doing a better job with our English language learners.
Well, I want to jump off of that point, too, of the what have we learned so far. Again, when we talked to Nima this morning, she mentioned the high level of turnover in Boston. And I'm curious, you know, even in just my tenure here in the Massachusetts area, I've seen three different superintendents. And so here are the concerns Nima had in her words.
Every incoming superintendent talks about trust, but then, like, I have been in Boston since 2003, and I'm pretty sure I've had 9 different people in the superintendent position since I started working in this district. Fundamentally, there's not going to be trust when we have that level of turn. It's not possible. Trust requires longstanding relationships, and those relationships get formed over time. It can't be like I had one interaction with you and now I trust you.
And quickly, Paul, why do you think there's so much turnover in this position?
Well, it's endemic. It's national. I just went to a conference a couple of weeks ago about the imperiled superintendency and the fact that there's a 25% annual turnover rate in superintendencies, up from 13%, and at a level of about 30 to 35% in urban districts. So it's not unique to Boston. These are getting to be tougher and tougher positions to lead from, especially during the time of the pandemic. But having said that, getting a leader like Mary Skipper, who is known for long-term commitment, and I just predict Mary's going to be a superintendent who will last longer than, for example, either of the last two incumbents in that position, because she's got deep roots in this community. It's her community. It's her school system. She's spent the bulk of her career there, and she's got the relationships. And as Nima said, it's all about relationships making this happen. It's about trust building. And the good thing that Mary brings, and one of the things that the search committee was looking for, were people who not only knew Boston, but were known in Boston. So they had those relationships as a starting point. So
which I think is something that the other superintendents that have come in didn't necessarily have the advantage of, Brenda Caselius and Tommy Chang. That's a really good point. Okay.
Yeah, through no fault of their own. And they both made very strong efforts and committed deeply to work and made progress. But it's easier if you have that network of relationships and that trust. And I think Mary starts with that.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Massachusetts Secretary of Education under Governor Deval Patrick. Okay, Paul, stay with us. We're going to bring you back in the conversation, but I do want to bring in one other voice to the conversation just briefly. Ruby Reyes is the director of Boston Education Justice Alliance, or BEJA, which is a community education advocacy group. Hey, Ruby, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me and making space for this important conversation.
Well, I want to start first by just having you reflect on what you've heard so far in this conversation and just the big week we've had.
We've had a huge week. I guess for me, some reflections around some of the things that I heard is just really, pushing forth the idea that it isn't just about these folks. It's really about, I think, the receivership issue, about families and school communities really just coming together to fight for a seat at the decision-making table and their voices being there. So I really want to highlight that because I think that I haven't, those are the pieces that are missing in terms of kind of these issues is families and school communities who are directly impacted by all of these decisions that are being made for them, about them, without them, have really just galvanized and come together to really fight to say that they want their public schools and they want to have a seat at the decision-making table. So I really think that that's one of the most beautiful parts of what has, I guess, come out of all of these really stressful times.
Well, and I know there were two areas that the state flagged as concerning when it came to that discussion of state takeover or state involvement. And those two areas of concern were special education services and services for English learners. So given that we have new leadership at BPS, what do you think Skipper should be doing or start to do to help address those concerns?
Well, I think with special education, we're at such a point where families are just so desperate for services and needs. And there's been so much turnover in central office staffing around actually knowing you know, supports and resources for families that are entitled to these services. I would hope that Superintendent Skipper would really look into building that level of infrastructure that's sorely missing for families in terms of processes and procedures for when families, require these resources and making sure that they're effectively given. I will say that I have a lot of concerns around some of the things that Mary Skipper shared in her interviews around like native language literacy and English learners. There was moments where, one of our school committee members brought up the LOOK Act in terms of native language literacy, and Skipper's response was that if this is something the community wanted, yes, she would, definitely be committed to it. And for me, it was kind of a red flag, because it's a state law. It's not something the community wants. It is a state law. I think I'm very cautiously, concerned and definitely, vigilant around how Superintendent Skipper will start to address some of the needs around these specific areas.
That's Ruby Reyes, director of Boston Education Justice Alliance, a community education advocacy group. Ruby, thank you so much for joining this conversation today.
Thank you.
Now, Paul, quickly, I want to return to you. In your view, what is the most important thing for BPS to focus on moving forward?
I think it's strategy. We've done a good job diagnostically of identifying the problems. Now it's a question of what do we do? What do we do Monday morning to begin to solve these problems? And agreeing on a set of strategies that work for kids and work for the professionals who are charged with implementing them, and that makes sense, as Ruby said, to families in the community.
All right, that's Paul Revel, former Massachusetts Secretary of Education, now a professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Paul, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Carrie Young. This is Radio Boston.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson,
do solemnly swear,
do solemnly swear,
that I will administer justice,
that I will administer justice,
without respect to persons,
without respect to persons,
and do equal right,
and do equal right,
to the poor and to the rich,
to the poor and to the rich.
That was just a piece of what we heard during a historic day yesterday. That was retiring Justice Stephen Breyer administering the judicial oath to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Ketanji Brown Jackson is now the 116th Justice of the Supreme Court and the first Black woman to serve on the highest court in the land. While she has been sworn in, we should note that the court is now out of session and she will formally join the Supreme Court in the fall. In her remarks, Jackson noted that it had taken 232 years and 115 prior appointments for a Black woman to take the bench. Joining us now to unpack this moment, we have friend of the show and Boston Globe senior opinion writer and columnist, Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Kimberly, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Good to be with you.
First, can you just reflect on this moment? What are your thoughts right now?
Yeah, it's really momentous. I mean, for the highest court in our nation to better reflect what America looks like, since they are making many consequential decisions that affect us all, I think is really important. Certainly, as a Black woman myself, who went to law school and didn't have someone like Justice Jackson as a model, as an example of what was possible, I feel grateful that she is there now, and for all of the young people who are looking up and do have that as an inspiration, not just for Black and Brown folks, but for everyone to see this is what success looks like in the legal field and in America.
So I think you make a really great point. Her appointment is very historic for a lot of reasons, but she's not actually going to change the political makeup on the court, right? So can you describe what her presence will change?
Yes. So now this is still a 6-3 court, by and large, that leans toward the conservative side. There are three Democratic appointees. She's one of them, and six Republican appointees. But what so in her actual job, she will mostly, when there is a highly contentious issue, she will likely be in the minority, and her opinions, if she writes them, will be dissents. Dissents are for the future, as the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would say, and sometimes they can have an impact. You know, Ginsburg wrote a dissent in an equal pay case that ended that caused Congress to act, and it was the first act that was signed into law by President Obama, making it easier for women to sue if they are underpaid per their male counterparts. So it can have an impact, but it will be, in terms of the rulings themselves, it'll be less. Of course, her own presence, her own experiences as the justices discuss and deliberate these questions will be important. She does have that different perspective than others. So there will be some impact there. But yes, she will more likely than not be in the minority in most of the decisions.
Now, there are some Boston ties to talk about here. There are Boston ties to Breyer and Ketanji Brown Jackson. So, Kimberly, I want to ask you, too, when you went to law school and you got your master's in journalism right here at BU, you practiced law here before you turned to journalism. Can you reflect a little bit about your experience being a Black lawyer and a woman in Boston? How did that shape you, and how do you think that's going to shape Justice Jackson?
You know, during her confirmation hearing, she recounted a story when she was on campus at Harvard as a student, having been there growing up in Florida, and how different it felt from anything that was recognizable to her in so many ways, and that it must have shown on her face because another Black woman passed her and just whispered to her, "Persevere." And she understood exactly what she was saying. And I understood that, too. I very rarely saw another lawyer of color when I was practicing law in Boston in the 90s. I was one of seven Black people in a class of 400 in my law school. So I know how that feels to be one of the few, one of the only in those spaces. And so I think that that certainly, she talked about it in a way that certainly reflected that that had a big impact on her understanding of the way the country can feel, certainly in those spaces. Right now, she's the only Black woman who has ever been on the Supreme Court. So in that way, she is prepared for that. But also, as I said, she brings that different view, that different perspective that is so important, that reflects millions of others in America who've had experiences similar to hers.
And as we mentioned, too, Justice Breyer also has Boston connections. He went to Harvard, taught at Harvard. He was a judge around here, and he lives in Cambridge. So how do you think all of these local connections and experiences impacted the way he served in the court?
Well, you know, I think it has an impact. Sometimes it's direct. You know, he was the writer of an opinion over the challenge to Boston's decision to allow people to raise flags on City Hall Plaza. And he described the whole scene very well, probably from memory, right? Because it's a place that's very familiar to him. And certainly, I think for him and all the justices, their backgrounds, where they come from, is important to how they understand the world. You know, he's a coastal guy. He's from California, but as you said, spent a great deal of time on the East Coast in Boston. You have other justices that are from more of the center part of the country, like Neil Gorsuch or Amy Coney Barrett. And all of those things come to bear in their understanding about how decisions will impact people. And so I think having that diversity of geography, which the court hasn't already had, it was very coastal for a very long period of time. It's only in recent years that you've had that increased diversity, including Justice Jackson, who is from Florida. There was no other justice from Florida. So all of these things come to bear in some way or another.
You know, it kind of feels like the eyes of, average people, they're on the Supreme Court in a really intense way right now. There was strong public opposition to both the recent overturning of Roe and the way the court came down on the question around concealed carry. The PBS NewsHour reported that nearly 6 in 10 Americans polled thought that the Roe decision was based on politics more than the law. And even a Gallup poll said that only 25% of Americans have confidence in the Supreme Court right now, which is the lowest in 50 years. So, Kimberly, do you think these partisan feelings that are coming out right now, do you think that could impact the Supreme Court's legitimacy?
Yeah, I think it very well could. I mean, the Supreme Court is supposed to operate apolitically, and it is not supposed to be swayed by public opinion. But of course, public opinion is important for people to have faith and trust in the work of the court and belief in that their decisions are just. And I do think that when the perception even of partisanship, of ideological work, is when the court has that perception, it really is harmful to it. I think a lot of times you see people, including the Chief Justice, Chief Justice John Roberts tried often to build as much consensus as he could, not only just so that each ruling, the more consensus it has, the more power it carries, but also to protect the institution of the court. I think increasingly we are seeing he's not able to do that. You're seeing the partisan lines on the court being drawn more starkly, the same way they seem to be drawn across the country, which can't, I don't blame people for really wondering if the court has been affected with the same kind of politics as other Washington institutions.
All right, that was friend of the show and Boston Globe columnist Kimberly Atkins-Storer. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you have travel plans this July 4th weekend, you're probably looking at some pretty gnarly plans, at least some gnarly experiences on the road and in the air. According to the travel website FlightAware, even this morning, early birds faced some travel hiccups. By 10 a.m., there were 59 delayed flights and 8 canceled ones. There's a lot going on that's contributing to these travel challenges, so let's untangle that. We're talking to Katie Thompson. She's on the transportation beat for WCVB Channel 5. Katie, welcome.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Katie, I actually want to start with a little bit of tape in this segment that we got from someone who was stranded at Logan. This is Lauren White. She was flying through Logan on her way to Lisbon, Portugal. She was delayed at Logan for 2 days. She finally got a flight from Boston to JFK to get one step closer there. We caught up with her from her seat on the plane just before takeoff, so let's listen.
The travel nightmare started when we flew from Atlanta to Boston en route to Lisbon. We got on our flight to Lisbon, and they told us that there was a valve that wouldn't close. It was a mechanical problem. Delta turned out roughly 300 people from this airplane out into Logan Airport at 2 a.m. No one was rescheduling flights. No one gave us hotel vouchers. We came out of pocket to put ourselves up in the Hampton Inn at Logan International Airport. We're hemorrhaging money at this point because of unexpected travel expenses.
I love that term, hemorrhaging money. Yeah. It's very visceral. Okay, so during this process, Lauren was separated from her husband, her 5-year-old daughter, and their Boston Terrier, Sprocket. And they were on a separate flight entirely. So, Katie, does this match with the kind of stories that you're hearing on the ground?
Yeah, anecdotally, Carrie, this is exactly what we're hearing. And a lot of it is international travel. Right now, we're talking to people who have had trips planned that were postponed several times during the pandemic. Now they're just getting to go on them. And just this morning, we talked to a family from Reading who have been trying to get to Italy for a guided trip that began on Tuesday. Unfortunately, today's Friday. They still haven't been able to get there. The trip has started. The guide is going on, and they had to come to the conclusion today to just call it a wash and not go on that trip.
That is so devastating.
It really is when you think about how long some of these people have been waiting to go on trips and all of the money that it took for them to actually make it happen.
Okay, so we've talked about this increase in demand for travel, but are there other factors behind some of this?
I think we are just now getting some more transparency from the airlines that this has been building for a while. This is coming out of a growing labor shortage in the airline industry. Pilots, runway people, flight attendants, you name it, there's a shortage. And at the same time, you're having to deal with pilots that are working a lot of overtime, needing to take some time off. So that's just leading to a number of flights that are going unstaffed and cancellations that are happening kind of abruptly for flyers.
So on that labor note, you know, we've been hearing that a significant number of Delta pilots are on strike right now. What have you heard about how that might have an impact on the travel scene this weekend, especially.
Delta has promised that the picketing going on with their pilots right now will not affect flights. We have seen flight cancellations and delays from Delta. They're not necessarily even attributing that to the pilots that are picketing. The pilots are picketing because they say they want better pay and better hours, and that so far in the first half of this year, they've worked more overtime than they would work in 2018 and 2019 combined.
Okay, have you been to Logan today? What's the scene like there?
Logan today, I was actually flying out of Logan 1 week ago. I would say a week ago today was a little bit busier, but Logan, the first flight out, always the busiest time. There were, as of a couple hours ago, as you mentioned, a handful of cancellations and delays. So you got to get there early, no matter what.
That's always what we hear from airport officials, too. But eternally good advice, I think.
Certainly.
So I should add that we did reach out to Massport, which is the agency that runs Logan Airport. And while they did decline to speak with us, they did provide a statement. And part of what they said was that the airlines have been vocal about their staffing challenges, like you mentioned, and have taken steps to reduce their schedules and put less pressure on the system. They also said that weather and other factors have impacted things as well. So I want to shift gears here a little bit to the roads. What can we look forward to on the roads this weekend? Any issues that you can foresee, or is it still too early to tell?
If you haven't left for your destination for 4th of July weekend, you're going to be sitting in traffic. We anticipate that the busiest hours today will be between the hours of 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. That was the same thing for yesterday. 48 million people in America are traveling over the next 4 days. 42 million will be in a car. In Massachusetts, it's a similar breakdown. About 88% of people traveling from Massachusetts will be behind the wheel. So the majority of people traveling are on the roads.
I mean, I guess to me that's somewhat surprising given the price of gas right now. What do you make of that?
It's not stopping people from getting to their destinations. It's not stopping people from planning vacations. There's so much pent-up demand for travel that people are willing to pay a little extra at the pump. The good news, if you want to call it that, we're down 9 cents this week. So maybe that's a bright spot. It's progress.
It's progress. Have you heard of anyone that's been changing their plans recently just to try to get away from some of these issues you mentioned?
I think people are altering them if they haven't had long-standing vacation plans. Maybe they're just deciding to do more of a staycation or travel a shorter distance. The majority of people AAA was citing, speaking to, were driving 50 miles or more, which is a significant amount for the holiday weekend.
Okay, and you mentioned getting to the airport early. If you're going to fly, driving, you mentioned some bad times to go out. Are there any other tips or tricks that travelers should keep in mind as they head out today?
I think definitely using those apps like Waze and Google Maps and Apple Maps, they are doing real-time GPS for you, and they will help you get to your destination in the quickest way possible. If there's a crash up 50 miles ahead of you, that's going to be there for a while. It'll help you route around that. Patience. I know it's super cliche. Snacks in the car, and just a good attitude overall, but certainly giving yourself plenty of time, which I think is why we're seeing a lot of people who took yesterday and today off.
Just knowing that flexibility has to be the name of the game here. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was Katie Thompson, who covers transportation for WCVB Channel 5 here in Boston. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
We are so close to the weekend. You are almost there. And with the long weekend, maybe you're thinking about what you're going to do with it. Well, if you ask Marty Fuller, she'll probably suggest going for a hike.
Just as soon as I walk out the door and just breathe the air, feel the breeze, I just feel more alive. I just feel at peace. I feel hopeful. I feel invigorated. I just need it. I just know that I need it.
Fuller, a nearly lifelong walker and hiker, is the star of a new documentary called Marty and the Whites, directed by her friend and fellow hiker, Paula Champagne. It aired at the Roxbury Film Festival this week and is available to stream in full for free online right now. In it, she explores her relationship to hiking as a Black woman and how she's working to encourage other Black and Indigenous people of color to find their way back to nature. Marty joins me in the studio right now. And Marty, I understand that your car is actually packed up, ready to go right now. You're heading out for a hike in Maine this weekend?
I am. And I will be hitting the road and anticipating some traffic. Thank you, Katie, for letting me know about my impending doom on the roads, perhaps. But I'm headed up to Baxter State Park in northern Maine to hike Mount Katahdin, which is the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail.
That sounds beautiful, and I'm a little jealous, actually. Well, thank you for making a pit stop with us. And I think one of the first questions I want to ask you is, what is your earliest memories of hiking and being outdoors? Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I grew up in New York in kind of the suburbs, rural area, almost rural area. My parents are from Jamaica, and they're from a rural background. So we were always kind of outside walking and enjoying nature. But it wasn't until school hikes or church hikes that I would go on extended periods in the mountains. And my earliest memories of finding such joy in hiking are really simple ones. Going on a hike in the Southern Adirondacks that ended with a jump into a deep lake and just how satisfying that felt.
That sounds amazing. That sounds amazing. Okay, well, that's a great memory in your youth, but why is this something that you've continued to do in your adulthood?
Wow, yeah. So I have almost haven't even had a need to articulate it because I just feel so myself when I'm outside, when I'm in nature, when I am listening to the wind blow through the leaves. And it's just been so important to my mental health, and it's been a way for me to just process my life and to spend time with folks and just kind of get away from, you know, the buzz of city life, which I've also felt I need. So it's just been a great kind of duality to live in.
Now, the film that you're in, Marty and the Whites, in that film, you talk about your relationship with hiking and how it started one way and then changed over time. First, here's a clip from that film where you talk about that shift.
There are a few times when there's been a behavior or action that's been so jarring that it's been painful. There have been sometimes, but those are few. And what is much more common is a number of small behaviors or words spoken or dynamics that add up and really detract from not just my experience, but my sense of self, and have made me feel like I'm shrinking.
So can you tell us a little bit more about this quote? How things have changed for you?
Sure. So just in case folks don't know, the title, Marty and the Whites, is a little bit of a double entendre, referring to the White Mountains of New Hampshire, where I've done most of my hiking over the last 20 years. And my experience is one of an identity journey and identity formation over that time. And that is because as a Black woman, I was always, I can't even say almost always, but in those beginning years, I was always the only Black person. And I was usually the only person of color. And on the one hand, I really enjoyed being with my fellow outdoors people. They were very kind, and they shared knowledge. They taught me things. They shared their snacks. But at the same time, many of those folks were not aware of their I kind of like to phrase it as an unconscious commitment to the invisibility of whiteness. So they weren't aware of racial dynamics, of kind of some of more subtle layers of racism that can impact a person, especially when, as a Black woman, I'm spending extended amounts of time with them and we're committed together as a team. You know, we're out for a full day or maybe for several days backpacking. And there can be a number of not just specific microaggressions, which, you know, that occurred, but then also just dynamics that play out over time. And it added up, and I realized that I needed to spend more time with Black people and people of color out in nature and not just in a white community.
And why did you feel like it was important to have these experiences documented and have this film created?
Sure. So the filmmaker Paula Champagne and I believe, had two goals. One is to speak to other Black people and people of color in predominantly white institutions or spaces. And in this case, the predominantly white institution is outdoor culture or the hiking community, and say, we see you. We validate your experience. You're not alone. There are subtle things that happen, that are said, that might make you uncomfortable. Or just you're with folks who aren't sharing your day-to-day experience, and this is the weekend when you want to get away from, you know, the impacts of racism that we're experiencing on a day-to-day basis in our work or school or regular life, and you want that time to kind of reconstitute and remind yourself, wait, I am worthy, I am valuable, I am strong, I am beautiful, even though this world built on white supremacy sends me messages all the time that say that's not the case.
Well, and I want to play another clip from the film now, too, that relates to this. And it's when you're talking about Black communities reclaiming hiking and turning trauma into joy.
We need to reclaim the joy of being alone in the woods without the generational memory of atrocities that could happen to Black people in the woods. We also need to reclaim natural spaces, parks.
So I hear that you lead groups, and I think you mentioned it already on the program too, that you lead groups of other Black men and women, other people of color, on hikes. So can you talk a little bit more about those experiences? What are your trips like?
Absolutely. So I do so informally, bringing friends and colleagues out into the mountains, but I also am a volunteer leader with a group called Outdoor Afro, which is a national organization with, I believe, 53 networks around the country. And so in Boston, I'm one of four volunteer leaders, and we organize all sorts of events. And the aim is to get folks connecting in nature and also leading in nature. And this could be anything from bird watching or nature journaling to ice climbing. These are all activities that we have done in the last year. And so when I gather with those folks, and I join the group first as a member just to be in community, not necessarily because I needed the opportunities to access these activities, because I already had built that up. I needed the community of other Black folks. And I have found that when we're all out together, you know, at the end of the event, we're saying things like, wow, I didn't even know I needed this.
So you've said before, too, that hiking is a form of resistance. Can you dive into that a little bit more and what that means?
Gosh, so I believe when I said that, I was, you know, talking about being free in my Black identity in the hiking world and the hiking community, where I may implicitly be asked to kind of conform to the norms of the culture that exists, that has essentially been built up by a majority white community. And instead, I'm coming in and I'm bringing my own way of expressing who I am in that space, my own way of interacting with the land that may be different, and my own way of kind of our own way, along with other Black people and other people of color, of engaging in that activity.
Okay. And so going back to the name of the film, Marty and the Whites, it's talking about your love of the White Mountains. You're there quite a bit, but you're going not to the White Mountains this weekend. You're going up to Maine. So are you primarily going to the White Mountains? What's your usual sort of like stomping grounds, maybe?
Yeah. So I love the entire region, from the west kind of Franconia Ridge area all the way to the eastern side, which is into Maine. I'm often up in the North Conway area, but I try to kind of get around and experience some of the more off-the-beaten-path hikes and climbs and, you know, finding lakes and ponds. So, yeah, I'm everywhere.
Well, what about the landscape? I guess, what's your favorite part? What do you like to see? What gives you joy when you're out there?
Yeah, so I love that we have some beautiful above tree line stretches in the White Mountains, which is unique to East Coast hiking. And so I love getting up and having expansive views, but I also just love how green and how varied our forests are in New Hampshire.
I know one of my favorite things is to hear the sound of the rustling leaves. It's just one of the most relaxing things you can get.
Yes, exactly. I've been trying to be more present to some of the smaller, simpler beauties, like noticing mushrooms and noticing, you know, alpine flowers. And so, yes, completely agree with you on that.
All right. And you did bring some hiking recommendations with you, I hear. So do you mind taking a second to share some of those?
I would love to share. So I would absolutely recommend a couple local hikes and then a few hikes in the White Mountains if folks are able to make the 2-hour to 3-hour trek up there. Locally, I just love Breakheart Reservation, which is in Saugus and Wakefield, and just beautiful forested area, two large lakes, runs along the Saugus River. Most of the hiking is fairly easy, and there's a little bit of moderate climbing. The Breakheart Reservation Trail is 2-mile flat loop, which I'd recommend, and then you can ascend Breakheart Hill for views of Boston. I live in Dorchester near Blue Hills. I go there once a week.
And I was hoping you'd mention that.
Yes, just love the one of the things I love about the Blue Hills is that it's a really diverse environment because there are so many Black people and people of color who live in Dorchester, Mattapan, Randolph, and the surrounding areas. So you'll see a diversity of people. I love hiking to Great Blue Hill and also going up the ski hill as a workout. Everyone encourages you and kind of encourage you to kind of reach the summit. It's kind of a community. In the White Mountains, Arethusa Falls and Ripley Falls and Crawford Notch, beautiful, easy hike to two of the tallest waterfalls in New Hampshire. I'd also recommend Greeley Ponds on the west side near Waterville Valley. And then two moderate hikes that are my favorite are the Sugar Loaves near Twin Mountain, which 3.5 miles and 1,000 feet of elevation gain get you to some beautiful views. You can also cut that in half and just do one. And then finally, where Marty and the Whites was filmed, Mount Crawford, which is about a 5.5 mile hike with 2,000 feet of elevation gain, and just stunning.
So something for everyone there, it sounds like. We are going to have all of those recommendations on our website, in case you didn't write that down. That's Marty Fuller, lifelong hiker and star of the documentary Marty and the Whites. You can watch the film in full at paulachampagne.com. Marty, thank you for joining us and safe travels today.
Thank you, Carrie.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Maya Schwader and Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Titus Faladin is our executive producer. I'm Carrie Young. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.